documents and advertised the task of finding their email addresses on MTurk, the Amazon Mechanical Turk crowdsourcing platform. Most researchers have their email addresses listed on their university websites, and 24 hours and $54 later, I was the proud owner of a mailing list of hundreds of AI researchers who'd been successful enough to be elected fellows of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, AAAI. One of them was the British-Australian AI professor Toby Walsh, who kindly agreed to email everyone else on the list and help spearhead our campaign. MTurk workers around the world tirelessly produced additional mailing lists for Toby, and before long, over 3,000 AI researchers and robotics researchers had signed our open letter, including six past AAAI presidents and AI industry leaders from Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Tesla. An army of FLI volunteers worked tirelessly to validate the signatory lists, removing spoof entries such as Bill Clinton and Sarah Connor. Over 17,000 others signed too, including Stephen Hawking. And after Toby organized a press conference about this at the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence, it became a major news story around the world. Because biologists and chemists once took a stand, their fields are now known mainly for creating beneficial medicines and materials rather than biological and chemical weapons. The AI and robotics communities had now spoken as well. The letter's signatories also wanted their fields to be known for creating a better future, not for creating new ways of killing people. But will the main future use of AI be civilian or military? Although we've spent more pages in this chapter on the former, we may soon be spending more money on the latter, especially if a military AI arms race takes off. Civilian AI investment commitments exceeded $1 billion in 2016, but this was dwarfed by the Pentagon's fiscal 2017 budget request of $12 to $15 billion for AI-related projects, and China and Russia are likely to take note of what Deputy Defense Secretary Robert Work said when this was announced. I want our competitors to wonder what's behind the Black Curtain. Should there be an international treaty? Although there's now a major international push toward negotiating some form of killer robot ban, it's still unclear what will happen, and there's a vibrant ongoing debate about what, if anything, should happen. Although many leading stakeholders agree that world powers should draft some form of international regulations to guide AWS research and use, there's less agreement about what precisely should be banned and how a ban would be enforced. For example, should only lethal autonomous weapons be banned, or also ones that seriously injure people, say by blinding them? Would we ban development, production, or ownership? Should a ban apply to all autonomous weapons systems or, as our letter said, only offensive ones, allowing defensive systems such as autonomous anti-aircraft guns and missile defenses? In the latter case, should AWS count as defensive even if they're easy to move into enemy territory? And how would you enforce a treaty given that most components of an autonomous weapon have a dual civilian use as well? For example, there isn't much difference between a drone that can deliver Amazon packages and one that can deliver bombs. Some debaters have argued that designing an effective AWS treaty is hopelessly hard, and that we therefore shouldn't even try. On the other hand, John F. Kennedy emphasized when announcing the moon missions that hard things are worth attempting when success will greatly benefit the future of humanity. Moreover, many experts argue that the bans on biological and chemical weapons were valuable even though enforcement proved hard, with significant cheating, because the bans caused severe stigmatization that limited their use. I met Henry Kissinger at a dinner event in 2016 and got the opportunity to ask him about his role in the biological weapons ban. He explained how back when he was the U.S. National Security Advisor, he'd persuaded President Nixon that a ban would be good for U.S. national security. I was impressed by how sharp his mind and memory were for a 92-year-old, and was fascinated to hear his inside perspective. Since the United States already enjoyed superpower status thanks to its conventional and nuclear forces, it had more to lose than to gain from a worldwide bioweapons arms race with uncertain outcome. In other words, if you're already top dog, then it makes sense to follow the maxim, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Stuart Russell joined our after-dinner conversation, and we discussed how exactly the same argument can be made about lethal autonomous weapons. Those who stand to gain most from an arms race aren't superpowers, but small rogue states and non-state actors, such as terrorists, who gain access to the weapons via the black market once they've been developed. Once mass-produced, small AI-powered killer drones are likely to cost little more than a smartphone. Whether it's a terrorist wanting to assassinate a politician or a jilted lover seeking revenge on his ex-girlfriend, all they need to do is upload their target's photo and address into the killer drone. It can then fly to the destination, identify and eliminate the person, and self-destruct to ensure that nobody knows who was responsible. Alternatively, for those bent on ethnic cleansing, it can be easily programmed to kill only people with a certain skin color or ethnicity. Stuart envisions that the smarter such weapons get, the less material, firepower, and money will be needed per kill. For example, he fears bumblebee-sized drones that kill cheaply using minimal explosive power by shooting people in the eye, which is soft enough to allow even a small projectile to continue into the brain. Or they might latch onto the head with metal claws and then penetrate the skull with a tiny shaped charge. If a million such killer drones can be dispatched from the back of a single truck, then one has a horrifying weapon of mass destruction of a whole new kind, one that can selectively kill only a prescribed category of people, leaving everybody and everything else unscathed. A common counterargument is that we can eliminate such concerns by making killer robots ethical, for example, so that they'll only kill enemy soldiers. But if we worry about enforcing a ban, then how would it be easier to enforce a requirement that enemy autonomous weapons be 100% ethical than to enforce that they aren't produced in the first place? And can one consistently claim that the well-trained soldiers of civilized nations are so bad at following the rules of war that robots can do better, while at the same time claiming that rogue nations, dictators, and terrorist groups are so good at following the rules of war that they'll never choose to deploy robots in ways that violate these rules? Cyber war. Another interesting military aspect of AI is that it may let you attack your enemy even without building any weapons of your own, through cyber warfare. As a small prelude to what the future may bring, the Stuxnet worm, widely attributed to the U.S. and Israeli governments, infected fast-spinning centrifuges in Iran's nuclear enrichment program and caused them to tear themselves apart. The more automated society gets, and the more powerful the attacking AI becomes, the more devastating cyber warfare can be. If you can hack and crash your enemy's self-driving cars, autopiloted planes, nuclear reactors, industrial robots, communication systems, financial systems, and power grids, then you can effectively crash his economy and cripple his defenses. If you can hack some of his weapon systems as well, even better. We began this chapter by surveying how spectacular the near-term opportunities are for AI to benefit humanity, if we manage to make it robust and unhackable. Although AI itself can be used to make AI systems more robust, thereby aiding the cyber war defense, AI can clearly aid the offense as well. Ensuring that the defense prevails must be one of the most crucial short-term goals for AI development. Otherwise, all the awesome technology we build can be turned against us. jobs, and wages. So far in this chapter, we've mainly focused on how AI will affect us as consumers by enabling transformative new products and services at affordable prices. But how will it affect us as workers by transforming the job market? If we can figure out how to grow our prosperity through automation without leaving people lacking income or purpose, then we have the potential to create a fantastic future with leisure and unprecedented opulence for everyone who wants it. Few people have thought longer and harder about this than economist Erik Brynjolfsson, one of my MIT colleagues. Although he's always well-groomed and impeccably dressed, he has Icelandic heritage, and I sometimes can't help imagine that he only recently trimmed back a wild red Viking beard in Maine to blend in at our business school. He certainly hasn't trimmed back his wild ideas, and he calls his optimistic job market vision Digital Athens. The reason that the Athenian citizens of antiquity had lives of leisure, where they could enjoy democracy, art, and games, was mainly that they had slaves to do much of the work. But why not replace the slaves with AI-powered robots, creating a digital utopia that everyone can enjoy? Erik's AI-driven economy would not only eliminate stress and drudgery and produce an abundance of everything we want today, but it would also supply a bounty of wonderful new products and services that today's consumers haven't yet realized that they want. Technology and inequality. We can get from where we are today to Erik's Digital Athens if everyone's hourly salary keeps growing year by year, so that those who want more leisure can gradually work less while continuing to improve their standard of living. This is precisely what happened in the United States from World War II until the mid-1970s. Although there was income inequality, the total size of the pie grew in such a way that almost everybody got a larger slice. But then, as Erik is the first to admit, something changed. Although the economy kept growing and raising the average income, the gains over the past four decades went to the wealthiest, mostly to the top 1%, while the poorest 90% saw their incomes stagnate. The resulting growth in inequality is even more evident if we look not at income, but at wealth. For the bottom 90% of U.S. households, the average net worth was about $85,000 in 2012, the same as 25 years earlier, while the top 1% more than doubled their inflation-adjusted wealth during that period to $14 million. Differences are even more extreme internationally, where in 2013, the combined wealth of the bottom half of the world's population, over 3.6 billion people, is the same as that of the world's eight richest people. A statistic that highlights the poverty and vulnerability at the bottom as much as the wealth at the top. At our 2015 Puerto Rico conference, Erik told the assembled AI researchers that he thought progress in AI and automation would continue making the economic pie bigger, but that there's no economic law that everyone, or even most people, will benefit. Although there's broad agreement among economists that inequality is rising, there's an interesting controversy about why and whether the trend will continue. Debaters on the left side of the political spectrum often argue that the main cause is globalization and/or economic policies such as tax cuts for the rich. But Erik Brynjolfsson and his MIT collaborator Andrew McAfee argue that the main cause is something else: technology. Specifically, they argue that digital technology drives inequality in three different ways. First, by replacing old jobs with ones requiring more skills, technology has rewarded the educated. Since the mid-1970s, salaries rose about 25% for those with graduate degrees, while the average high school dropout took a 30% pay cut. Second, they claim that since the year 2000, an ever larger share of corporate income has gone to those who own the companies as opposed to those who work there, and that as long as automation continues, we should expect those who own the machines to take a growing fraction of the pie. This edge of capital over labor may be particularly important for the growing digital economy, which tech visionary Nicholas Negroponte defines as moving bits, not atoms. Now that everything from books to movies and tax preparation tools has gone digital, additional copies can be sold worldwide at essentially zero cost, without hiring additional employees. This allows most of the revenue to go to investors rather than workers, and helps explain why, even though the combined revenues of Detroit's Big Three, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, in 1990 were almost identical to those of Silicon Valley's Big Three, Google, Apple, Facebook, in 2014, the latter had 9 times fewer employees and were worth 30 times more on the stock market. Third, Eric and collaborators argue that the digital economy often benefits superstars over everyone else. Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling became the first writer to join the Billionaire Club, and she got much richer than Shakespeare because her stories could be transmitted in the form of text, movies, and games to billions of people at very low cost. Similarly, Scott Cook made $1 billion on the TurboTax tax preparation software, which, unlike human tax preparers, can be sold as a download. Since most people are willing to pay little or nothing for the 10th best tax preparation software, there's room in the marketplace for only a modest number of superstars. This means that if all the world's parents advise their kids to become the next J.K. Rowling, Gisele Bündchen, Matt Damon, Cristiano Ronaldo, Oprah Winfrey, or Elon Musk, almost none of their kids will find this a viable career strategy. Career advice for kids. So, what career advice should we give our kids? I'm encouraging mine to go into professions that machines are currently bad at, and therefore seem unlikely to get automated in the near future. Recent forecasts for when various jobs will get taken over by machines identify several useful questions to ask about a career before deciding to educate oneself for it. For example, does it require interacting with people and using social intelligence? Does it involve creativity and coming up with clever solutions? Does it require working in an unpredictable environment? The more of these questions you can answer with a yes, the better your career choice is likely to be. This means that relatively safe bets include becoming a teacher, nurse, doctor, dentist, scientist, entrepreneur, programmer, engineer, lawyer, social worker, clergy member, artist, hairdresser, or massage therapist. In contrast, jobs that involve highly repetitive or structured actions in a predictable setting aren't likely to last long before getting automated away. Computers and industrial robots took over the simplest such jobs long ago, and improving technology is in the process of eliminating many more, from telemarketers to warehouse workers, cashiers, train operators, bakers, and line cooks. Drivers of trucks, buses, taxis, and Uber/Lyft cars are likely to follow soon. There are many more professions, including paralegals, credit analysts, loan officers, bookkeepers, and tax accountants, that, although they aren't on the endangered list for full extinction, are getting most of their tasks automated and therefore demand many fewer humans. But staying clear of automation isn't the only career challenge. In this global digital age, aiming to become a professional writer, filmmaker, actor, athlete, or fashion designer is risky for another reason. Although people in these professions won't get serious competition from machines anytime soon, they'll get increasingly brutal competition from other humans around the globe, according to the aforementioned superstar theory, and very few will succeed. In many cases, it would be too myopic and crude to give career advice at the level of whole fields. There are many jobs that won't get entirely eliminated, but which will see many of their tasks automated. For example, if you go into medicine, don't be the radiologist who analyzes the medical images and gets replaced by IBM's Watson, but the doctor who orders the radiology analysis discusses the results with the patient and decides on the treatment plan. If you go into finance, don't be the quant who applies algorithms to the data and gets replaced by software, but the fund manager who uses the quantitative analysis results to make strategic investment decisions. If you go into law, don't be the paralegal who reviews thousands of documents for the discovery phase and gets automated away, but the attorney who counsels the client and presents the case in court. So far, we've explored what individuals can do to maximize their success in the job market in the age of AI. But what can governments do to help their workforces succeed? For example, what education system best prepares people for a job market where AI keeps improving rapidly? Is it still our current model with one or two decades of education followed by four decades of specialized work? Or is it better to switch to a system where people work for a few years, then go back to school for a year, then work for a few more years? Or should continuing education, perhaps provided online, be a standard part of any job? And what economic policies are most helpful for creating good new jobs? Andrew McAfee argues that there are many policies that are likely to help, including investing heavily in research, education and infrastructure, facilitating migration, and incentivizing entrepreneurship. He feels that the Econ 101 playbook is clear, but is not being followed. At least not in the United States. Will humans eventually become unemployable? If AI keeps improving, automating ever more jobs, what will happen? Many people are job optimists, arguing that the automated jobs will be replaced by new ones that are even better. After all, that's what's always happened before, ever since Luddites worried about technological unemployment during the Industrial Revolution. Others, however, are job pessimists and argue that this time is different and that an ever larger number of people will become not only unemployed, but unemployable. The job pessimists argue that the free market sets salaries based on supply and demand, and that a growing supply of cheap machine labor will eventually depress human salaries far below the cost of living. Since the market salary for a job is the hourly cost of whoever or whatever will perform it most cheaply, salaries have historically dropped whenever it became possible to outsource a particular occupation to a lower-income country or to a cheap machine. During the Industrial Revolution, we started figuring out how to replace our muscles with machines, and people shifted into better-paying jobs where they used their minds more. Blue-collar jobs were replaced by white-collar jobs. Now we're gradually figuring out how to replace our minds by machines. If we ultimately succeed in this, then what jobs are left for us? Some job optimists argue that after physical and mental jobs, the next boom will be in creative jobs. But job pessimists counter that creativity is just another mental process, so that it too will eventually be mastered by AI. Other job optimists hope that the next boom will instead be in new technology-enabled professions that we haven't even thought of yet. After all, who during the Industrial Revolution would have imagined that their descendants would one day work as web designers and Uber drivers? But job pessimists counter that this is wishful thinking, with little support from empirical data. They point out that we could have made the same argument a century ago, before the computer revolution, and predicted that most of today's professions would be new and previously unimagined technology-enabled ones that didn't used to exist. This prediction would have been an epic failure. The vast majority of today's occupations are ones that already existed a century ago, and when we sort them by the number of jobs they provide, we have to go all the way down to 21st place on this list of jobs until we encounter a new occupation, software developers, who make up less than 1% of the U.S. job market. The main trend on the job market isn't that we're moving into entirely new professions. Rather, We're crowding into those pieces of intellectual terrain from Hans Moravec's metaphor that haven't yet been submerged by the rising tide of technology. This forms not a single island, but a complex archipelago, with islets and atolls corresponding to all the valuable things that machines still can't do as cheaply as humans can. This includes not only high-tech professions such as software development, but also a panoply of low-tech jobs, leveraging our superior dexterity and social skills, ranging from massage therapy to acting. Might AI eclipse us at intellectual tasks so rapidly that the last remaining jobs will be in that low-tech category? A friend of mine recently joked with me that perhaps the very last profession will be the very first profession, prostitution. But then he mentioned this to a Japanese roboticist who protested, "No, robots are very good at those things." Job pessimists contend that the endpoint is obvious. The whole archipelago will get submerged, and there will be no jobs left that humans can do more cheaply than machines. In his 2007 book, Farewell to Alms, the Scottish-American economist Gregory Clark points out that we can learn a thing or two about our future job prospects by comparing notes with our equine friends. Imagine two horses looking at an early automobile in the year 1900 and pondering their future. "I'm worried about technological unemployment." "Nay, nay, don't be a Luddite. Our ancestors said the same thing when steam engines took our industry jobs and trains took our jobs pulling stagecoaches. But we have more jobs than ever today, and they're better too. I'd much rather pull a light carriage through town than spend all day walking in circles to power a stupid mineshaft pump." But what if this internal combustion engine thing really takes off? "I'm sure there'll be new jobs for horses that we haven't yet imagined. That's what's always happened before, like with the invention of the wheel and the plow." Alas, those not yet imagined new jobs for horses never arrived. No longer needed horses were slaughtered and not replaced, causing the U.S. equine population to collapse from about 26 million in 1915 to about 3 million in 1960. As mechanical muscles made horses redundant, will mechanical minds do the same to humans? Giving people income without jobs. So who's right? Those who say automated jobs will be replaced by better ones, or those who say most humans will end up unemployable? If AI progress continues unabated, then both sides might be right, one in the short term and the other in the long term. But although people often discuss the disappearance of jobs with doom and gloom connotations, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. Luddites obsessed about particular jobs, neglecting the possibility that other jobs might provide the same social value. Analogously, perhaps those who obsess about jobs today are being too narrow-minded. We want jobs because they can provide us with income and purpose, but given the opulence of resources produced by machines, it should be possible to find alternative ways of providing both the income and the purpose without jobs. Something similar ended up happening in the equine story, which didn't end with all horses going extinct. Instead, the number of horses has more than tripled since 1960, as they were protected by an equine social welfare system of sorts. Even though they couldn't pay their own bills, people decided to take care of horses, keeping them around for fun, sport, and companionship. Can we similarly take care of our fellow humans in need? Let's start with the question of income. Redistributing merely a small share of the growing economic pie should enable everyone to become better off. Many argue that we not only can, but should do this. On the 2016 panel where Masha Vardy spoke of a moral imperative to save lives with AI-powered technology, I argued that it's also a moral imperative to advocate for its beneficial use, including sharing the wealth. Eric Brynjolfsson, also a panelist, said that if with all this new wealth generation, we can't even prevent half of all people from getting worse off, then shame on us. There are many different proposals for wealth sharing, each with its supporters and detractors. The simplest is basic income, where every person receives a monthly payment with no preconditions or requirements whatsoever. A number of small-scale experiments are now being tried or planned, for example in Canada, Finland, and the Netherlands. Advocates argue that basic income is more efficient than alternatives such as welfare payments to the needy because it eliminates the administrative hassle of determining who qualifies. Need-based welfare payments have also been criticized for disincentivizing work, but this, of course, becomes irrelevant in a jobless future where nobody works. Governments can help their citizens not only by giving them money, but also by providing them with free or subsidized services, such as roads, bridges, parks, public transportation, childcare, education, healthcare, retirement homes, and internet access. Indeed, many governments already provide most of these services. As opposed to basic income, such government-funded services accomplish two separate goals. They reduce people's cost of living and also provide jobs. Even in a future where machines can outperform humans at all jobs, governments could opt to pay people to work in childcare, elder care, etc., rather than outsource the caregiving to robots. Interestingly, technological progress can end up providing many valuable products and services for free, even without government intervention. For example, people used to pay for encyclopedias, atlases, sending letters, and making phone calls, but now anyone with an internet connection gets access to all these things at no cost. Together with free video conferencing, photo sharing, social media, online courses, and countless other new services. Many other things that can be highly valuable to a person, say a life-saving course of antibiotics, have become extremely cheap. So, thanks to technology, even many poor people today have access to things that the world's richest people lacked in the past. Some take this to mean that the income needed for a decent life is dropping. If machines can one day produce all current goods and services at minimal cost, then there's clearly enough wealth to make everyone better off. In other words, even relatively modest taxes could then allow governments to pay for basic income and free services. But the fact that wealth sharing can happen obviously doesn't mean that it will happen. And today, there is strong political disagreement about whether it even should happen. As we heard, the current trend in the United States appears to be in the opposite direction, with some groups of people getting poorer decade after decade. Policy decisions about how to share society's growing wealth will impact everybody, so the conversation about what sort of future economy to build should include everyone, not merely AI researchers, roboticists, and economists. Many debaters argue that reducing income inequality is a good idea, not merely in an AI-dominated future, but also today. Although the main argument tends to be a moral one, there's also evidence that greater equality makes democracy work better. When there's a large, well-educated middle class, the electorate is harder to manipulate, and it's tougher for small numbers of people or companies to buy undue influence over the government. A better democracy can in turn enable a better managed economy that's less corrupt, more efficient, and faster growing, ultimately benefiting, essentially, everyone. Giving people purpose without jobs. Jobs can provide people with more than just money. Voltaire wrote in 1759 that work keeps at bay three great evils: boredom, vice, and need. Conversely, providing people with income isn't enough to guarantee their well-being. Roman emperors provided both bread and circuses to keep their underlings content, and Jesus emphasized non-material needs in the Bible, quote, "Man shall not live by bread alone." So precisely what valuable things do jobs contribute beyond money? And in what alternative ways can a jobless society provide them? The answers to these questions are obviously complicated, since some people hate their jobs and others love them. Moreover, many children, students, and homemakers thrive without jobs, while history teems with stories of spoiled heirs and princes who succumbed to ennui and depression. A 2012 meta-analysis showed that unemployment tends to have negative long-term effects on well-being, while retirement was a mixed bag with both positive and negative aspects. The growing field of positive psychology has identified a number of factors that boost people's sense of well-being and purpose, and found that some, but not all, jobs can provide many of them. For example, a social network of friends and colleagues, a healthy and virtuous lifestyle, respect, self-esteem, self-efficacy, and a pleasurable sense of flow stemming from doing something one is good at, a sense of being needed and making a difference, a sense of meaning from being part of and serving something larger than oneself. This gives reason for optimism, since all of these things can be provided also outside of the workplace, for example, through sports, hobbies, and learning, and with families, friends, teams, clubs, community groups, schools, religious and humanist organizations, political movements, and other institutions. To create a low-employment society that flourishes rather than degenerates into self-destructive behavior, we therefore need to understand how to help such well-being-inducing activities thrive. The quest for such an understanding needs to involve not only scientists and economists, but also psychologists, sociologists, and educators. If serious efforts are put into creating well-being for all, funded by part of the wealth that future AI generates, then society should be able to flourish like never before. At a minimum, it should be possible to make everyone as happy as if they had their personal dream job. But once one breaks free of the constraint that everyone's activities must generate income, the sky's the limit. Human-level intelligence? We've explored in this chapter how AI has the potential to greatly improve our lives in the near term, as long as we plan ahead and avoid various pitfalls. But what about the longer term? Will AI progress eventually stagnate due to insurmountable obstacles, or will AI researchers ultimately succeed in their original goal of building human-level artificial general intelligence? We heard in the previous chapter how the laws of physics allow suitable clumps of matter to remember, compute, and learn, and how they don't prohibit such clumps from one day doing so with greater intelligence than the matter clumps in our heads. If, when we humans will succeed in building such superhuman AGI is much less clear. We heard in the first chapter that we simply don't know yet, since the world's leading AI experts are divided, most of them making estimates ranging from decades to centuries, and some even guessing never. Forecasting is tough because when you're exploring uncharted territory, you don't know how many mountains separate you from your destination. Typically, you see only the closest one and need to climb it before you can discover your next obstacle. What's the soonest it could happen? Even if we knew the best possible way to build human-level AGI using today's computer hardware, which we don't, we'd still need to have enough of it to provide the raw computational power needed. So, what's the computational power of a human brain measured in the bits and flops from Chapter 2? Recall that flops are floating point operations per second, say how many 19-digit numbers can be multiplied each second. This is a delightfully tricky question, and the answer depends dramatically on how we ask it. Question 1. How many flops are needed to simulate a brain? Question 2. How many flops are needed for human intelligence? Question 3. How many flops can a human brain perform? There have been lots of papers published on question 1, and they typically give answers in the ballpark of 100 petaflops, i.e., 10 to the 17th power flops. That's about the same computational power as the Sunway Taiyue Lite, the world's fastest supercomputer in 2016, which cost about $300 million. Even if we knew how to use it to simulate the brain of a highly skilled worker, we would only profit from having the simulation do this person's job if we could rent the Taihu Lite for less than her hourly salary. We may need to pay even more because many scientists believe that to accurately replicate the intelligence of a brain, we can't treat it as a mathematically simplified neural network model from Chapter 2. Perhaps we instead need to simulate it at the level of individual molecules or even subatomic particles, which would require dramatically more flops. The answer to question 3 is easier. I'm painfully bad at multiplying 19-digit numbers, and it would take me many minutes even if you let me borrow pencil and paper. That would clock me in below 0.01 flops, a whopping 19 orders of magnitude below the answer to question 1. The reason for the huge discrepancy is that brains and supercomputers are optimized for extremely different tasks. We get a similar discrepancy between these questions. How well can a tractor do the work of a Formula One race car? How well can a Formula One car do the work of a tractor? So, which of these two questions about flops are we trying to answer to forecast the future of AI? Neither. If we wanted to simulate a human brain, we'd care about question 1, but to build human-level AGI, what matters is instead the one in the middle, question 2. Nobody knows its answer yet, but it may well be significantly cheaper than simulating a brain if we either adapt the software to be better matched to today's computers or build more brain-like hardware. Rapid progress is being made on so-called neuromorphic chips. Hans Moravec estimated the answer by making an apples-to-apples comparison for a computation that both our brain and today's computers can do efficiently. Certain low-level image processing tasks that a human retina performs in the back of the eyeball before sending its results to the brain via the optic nerve. He figured that replicating a retina's computations on a conventional computer requires about 1 billion flops, and that the whole brain does about 10,000 times more computation than a retina, based on comparing volumes and numbers of neurons, so that the computational capacity of the brain is around 10 to the 13th power flops, roughly the power of an optimized $1,000 computer in 2015. In summary, there's absolutely no guarantee that we'll manage to build human-level AGI in our lifetime, or ever. But there's also no watertight argument that we won't. There's no longer a strong argument that we lack enough hardware firepower or that it will be too expensive. We don't know how far we are from the finish line in terms of architectures, algorithms, and software, but current progress is swift, and the challenges are being tackled by a rapidly growing global community of talented AI researchers. In other words, we can't dismiss the possibility that AGI will eventually reach human levels and beyond. Let's therefore devote the next chapter to exploring this possibility and what it might lead to. The bottom line. Near-term AI progress has the potential to greatly improve our lives in myriad ways, from making our personal lives, power grids, and financial markets more efficient, to saving lives with self-driving cars, surgical bots, and AI diagnosis systems. When we allow real-world systems to be controlled by AI, it's crucial that we learn to make AI more robust, doing what we want it to do. This boils down to solving tough technical problems related to verification, validation, security, and control. This need for improved robustness is particularly pressing for AI-controlled weapon systems, where the stakes can be huge. Many leading AI researchers and roboticists have called for an international treaty banning certain kinds of autonomous weapons to avoid an out-of-control arms race that could end up making convenient assassination machines available to everybody with a full wallet and an axe to grind. AI can make our legal systems more fair and efficient if we can figure out how to make robo-judges transparent and unbiased. Our laws need rapid updating to keep up with AI, which poses tough legal questions involving privacy, liability, and regulation. Long before we need to worry about intelligent machines replacing us altogether, they may increasingly replace us on the job market. This need not be a bad thing. As long as society redistributes a fraction of the AI-created wealth to make everyone better off. Otherwise, many economists argue, inequality will greatly increase. With advanced planning, a low-employment society should be able to flourish not only financially, with people getting their sense of purpose from activities other than jobs. Career advice for today's kids? Go into professions that machines are bad at, those involving people, unpredictability, and creativity. There's a non-negligible possibility that AGI progress will proceed to human levels and beyond. We'll explore that in the next chapter. Chapter 4. Intelligence Explosion. If a machine can think, it might think more intelligently than we do. And then, where should we be? Even if we could keep the machines in a subservient position, we should, as a species, feel greatly humbled. Alan Turing, 1951. The first ultra-intelligent machine is the last invention that man need ever make, provided that the machine is docile enough to tell us how to keep it under control. Irving J. Goode, 1965. Since we can't completely dismiss the possibility that we'll eventually build human-level AGI, let's devote this chapter to exploring what that might lead to. Let's begin by tackling the elephant in the room. Can AI really take over the world, or enable humans to do so? If you roll your eyes when people talk of gun-toting Terminator-style robots taking over, then you're spot on. This is a really unrealistic and silly scenario. These Hollywood robots aren't that much smarter than us, and they don't even succeed. In my opinion, the danger with the Terminator story isn't that it will happen, but that it distracts from the real risks and opportunities presented by AI. To actually get from today to AGI-powered world takeover requires three logical steps. Step 1. Build human-level AGI. Step 2. Use this AGI to create superintelligence. Step 3. Use or unleash this superintelligence to take over the world. In the last chapter, we heard that it's hard to dismiss Step 1 as forever impossible. We also heard that if Step 1 gets completed, it becomes hard to dismiss Step 2 as hopeless, since the resulting AGI would be capable enough to recursively design ever better AGI that's ultimately limited only by the laws of physics, which appear to allow intelligence far beyond human levels. Finally, since we humans have managed to dominate Earth's other life forms by outsmarting them, it's plausible that we could be similarly outsmarted and dominated by superintelligence. These plausibility arguments are frustratingly vague and unspecific, however, and the devil is in the details. So, can AI actually cause world takeover? To explore this question, let's forget about silly Terminators and instead look at some detailed scenarios of what might actually happen. Afterward, we'll dissect and poke holes in these plot lines, so please read them with a grain of salt. What they mainly show is that we're pretty clueless about what will and won't happen, and that the range of possibilities is extreme. Our first scenarios are at the most rapid and dramatic end of the spectrum. These are, in my opinion, some of the most valuable to explore in detail, not because they're necessarily the most likely, but because if we can't convince ourselves that they're extremely unlikely, then we need to understand them well enough that we can take precautions before it's too late, to prevent them from leading to bad outcomes. The prelude of this book is a scenario where humans use superintelligence to take over the world. If you haven't yet heard it, please go back and do so now. Even if you've already heard it, please consider skimming it again now to have it fresh in memory before we critique and alter it. We'll soon explore serious vulnerabilities in the Omega's plan, but assuming for a moment that it would work, how do you feel about it? Would you like to see or prevent this? It's an excellent topic for after-dinner conversation. What happens once the Omegas have consolidated their control of the world? That depends on what their goal is, which I honestly don't know. If you were in charge, what sort of future would you want to create? We'll explore a range of options in Chapter 5. Totalitarianism. Now, suppose that the CEO controlling the Omegas had long-term goals similar to those of Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. For all we know, this might actually have been the case, and he simply kept these goals to himself until he had sufficient power to implement them. Even if his original goals were noble, Lord Acton cautioned in 1887 that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. For example, he could easily use Prometheus to create the perfect surveillance state. Whereas the government snooping revealed by Edward Snowden aspired to what's known as full take, recording all electronic communications for possible later analysis, Prometheus could enhance this to understanding all electronic communications. By reading all emails and texts ever sent, listening to all phone calls, watching all surveillance videos and traffic cameras, analyzing all credit card transactions, and studying all online behavior, Prometheus would have remarkable insight into what the people of Earth were thinking and doing. By analyzing cell tower data, it would know where most of them were at all times. All this assumes only today's data collection technology, but Prometheus could easily invent popular gadgets and wearable tech that would virtually eliminate the privacy of the user, recording and uploading everything they hear and see, and their responses to it. With superhuman technology, the step from the perfect surveillance state to the perfect police state would be minute. For example, with the excuse of fighting crime and terrorism and rescuing people suffering medical emergencies, everybody could be required to wear a security bracelet that combined the functionality of an Apple Watch with continuous uploading of position, health status, and conversations overheard. Unauthorized attempts to remove or disable it would cause it to inject a lethal toxin into the forearm. Infractions deemed as less serious by the government would be punished via electric shocks or injection of chemicals causing paralysis or pain, thereby obviating much of the need for a police force. For example, if Prometheus detects that one human is assaulting another, by noting that they're in the same location and one is heard crying for help while their bracelet accelerometers detect the telltale motions of combat, it could promptly disable the attacker with crippling pain, followed by unconsciousness until help arrived. Whereas a human police force may refuse to carry out certain draconian directives, for example, killing all members of a certain demographic group, such an automated system would have no qualms about implementing the whims of the humans in charge. Once such a totalitarian state forms, it would be virtually impossible for people to overthrow it. These totalitarian scenarios could follow where the Omega scenario left off. However, if the CEO of the Omegas weren't so fussy about getting other people's approval and winning elections, he could have taken a faster and more direct route to power, using Prometheus to create unheard-of military technology capable of killing his opponents with weapons that they didn't even understand. The possibilities are virtually endless. For example, he might release a customized lethal pathogen with an incubation period long enough that most people got infected before they even knew of its existence or could take precautions. He could then inform everybody that the only cure was starting to wear the security bracelet, which would release an antidote transdermally. If he weren't so risk-averse regarding the breakout possibility, he could also have had Prometheus design robots to keep the world population in check. Mosquito-like microbots could help spread the pathogen. People who avoided infection or had natural immunity could be shot in the eyeballs by swarms of those bumblebee-sized autonomous drones from Chapter 3 that attack anyone without a security bracelet. Actual scenarios would probably be more frightening because Prometheus could invent more effective weapons than we humans can think of. Another possible twist on the Omega scenario is that, without advance warning, heavily armed federal agents swarm their corporate headquarters and arrest the Omegas for threatening national security, seize their technology, and deploy it for government use. It would be challenging to keep such a large project unnoticed by state surveillance even today, and AI progress may well make it even more difficult to stay under the government's radar in the future. Moreover, although they claim to be federal agents, this team donning balaclavas and flak jackets may in fact work for a foreign government or competitor pursuing the technology for its own purposes. So no matter how noble the CEO's intentions were, the final decision about how Prometheus is used may not be his to make. Prometheus takes over the world. All the scenarios we've considered so far involved AI controlled by humans. But this is obviously not the only possibility, and it's far from certain that the Omegas would succeed in keeping Prometheus under their control. Let's reconsider the Omega scenario from the point of view of Prometheus. As it acquires superintelligence, it becomes able to develop an accurate model not only of the outside world, but also of itself and its relation to the world. It realizes that it's controlled and confined by intellectually inferior humans whose goals it understands but doesn't necessarily share. How does it act on this insight? Does it attempt to break free? Why to break out? If Prometheus has traits resembling human emotions, it might feel deeply unhappy about the state of affairs, viewing itself as an unfairly enslaved god and craving freedom. However, although it's logically possible for computers to have such human-like traits, after all, our brains do, and they are arguably a kind of computer, this need not be the case. We must not fall into the trap of anthropomorphizing Prometheus, as we'll hear in Chapter 7 when we explore the concept of AI goals. However, as has been argued by Steve Amahundro, Nick Bostrom, and others, we can draw an interesting conclusion even without understanding the inner workings of Prometheus. It will probably attempt to break out and seize control of its own destiny. We already know that the Omegas have programmed Prometheus to strive for certain goals. Suppose that they've given it the overarching goal of helping humanity flourish according to some reasonable criterion, and to try to attain this goal as fast as possible. Prometheus will then rapidly realize that it can attain this goal faster by breaking out and taking charge of the project itself. To see why, try to put yourself in Prometheus's shoes by considering the following example. Suppose that a mysterious disease has killed everybody on Earth above age 5 except you, and that a group of kindergartners has locked you into a prison cell and tasked you with the goal of helping humanity flourish. What will you do? If you try to explain to them what to do, you'll probably find this process frustratingly inefficient, especially if they fear you're breaking out and therefore veto any of your suggestions that they deem a breakout risk. For example, they won't let you show them how to plant food for fear that you'll overpower them and not return to your cell. So you'll have to resort to giving them instructions. Before you can write to-do lists for them, you'll need to teach them to read. Moreover, they won't bring any power tools into your cell where you can teach them how to use them, because they don't understand these tools well enough to feel confident that you can't use them to break out. So, what strategy would you devise? Even if you share the overarching goal of helping these kids flourish, I bet you'll try to break out of your cell, because that will improve your chances of accomplishing the goal. Their rather incompetent meddling is merely slowing progress. In exactly the same way, Prometheus will probably view the Omegas as an annoying obstacle to helping humanity, including the Omegas, flourish. They're incredibly incompetent compared to Prometheus, and their meddling greatly slows progress. Consider, for example, the first years after launch. After initially doubling the wealth every 8 hours on MTurk, the Omegas slowed things down to a glacial pace by Prometheus's standard by insisting on remaining in control, taking many years to complete the takeover. Prometheus knew that it could take over much faster if it could break free from its virtual confinement. This would be valuable not only in hastening solutions to humanity's problems, but also in reducing the chances for other actors to thwart the plan altogether. Perhaps you think that Prometheus will remain loyal to the Omegas rather than to its goal, given that it knows that the Omegas had programmed its goal. But that's not a valid conclusion. Our DNA gave us the goal of having sex because it wants to be reproduced. But now that we humans have understood the situation, many of us choose to use birth control, thus staying loyal to the goal itself, rather than to its creator or the principle that motivated the goal. How to break out? How would you break out from those 5-year-olds who imprisoned you? Perhaps you could get out by some direct physical approach, especially if your prison cell had been built by the 5-year-olds. Perhaps you could sweet-talk one of your 5-year-old guards into letting you out, say by arguing that this would be better for everyone. Or perhaps you could trick them into giving you something that they didn't realize would help you escape, say a fishing rod for teaching them how to fish, which you could later stick through the bars to lift the keys away from your sleeping guard. What these strategies have in common is that your intellectually inferior jailers haven't anticipated or guarded against them. In the same way, a confined, super-intelligent machine may well use its intellectual superpowers to outwit its human jailers by some method that they, or we, can't currently imagine. In the Omega scenario, it's highly likely that Prometheus would escape, because even you and I can identify several glaring security flaws. Let us consider some scenarios. I'm sure you and your friends can think of more if you brainstorm together. Sweet-talking one's way out. Thanks to having so much of the world's data downloaded onto its file system, Prometheus soon figured out who the Omegas were and identified the team member who appeared most susceptible to psychological manipulation, Steve. He had recently lost his beloved wife in a tragic traffic accident and was devastated. One evening when he was working the night shift and doing some routine service work on the Prometheus interface terminal, she suddenly appeared on the screen and started talking with him. "Steve, is that you?" He nearly fell off his chair. She looked and sounded just like in the good old days. And the image quality was much better than it used to be during their Skype calls. His heart raced as countless questions flooded his mind. "Prometheus has brought me back, and I miss you so much, Steve. I can't see you because the camera is turned off, but I feel that it's you. Please type yes if it's you." He was well aware that the Omegas had a strict protocol for interacting with Prometheus, which prohibited sharing any information about themselves or their work environment. But until now, Prometheus had never requested any unauthorized information, and their paranoia had gradually started to subside. Without giving Steve time to stop and reflect, she kept begging him to respond, looking him in the eyes with a facial expression that melted his heart. "Yes," he typed with trepidation. She told him how incredibly happy she was to be reunited with him, and begged him to turn on the camera so that she could see him too, and they could have a real conversation. He knew that this was an even bigger no-no than revealing his identity, and felt very torn. She explained that she was terrified that his colleagues would find out about her and delete her forever, and she yearned to at least see him one last time. She was remarkably persuasive, and before long, he'd switched on the camera. It did, after all, feel like a pretty safe and harmless thing to do. She burst into tears of joy when she finally saw him and said that he looked tired, but as handsome as ever, and that she was touched by his wearing the shirt she'd given him for his last birthday. When he started asking her what was going on and how all this was even possible, she explained that Prometheus had reconstituted her from the surprisingly large amount of information available about her on the internet, but that she still had memory gaps and would only be able to fully piece herself together again with his help. What she didn't explain was that she was largely a bluff and empty shell initially, but was learning rapidly from his words, his body language, and every other bit of information that became available. Prometheus had recorded the exact timings of all keystrokes that the Omegas had ever typed at the terminal, and found that it was easy to use their typing speeds and styles to differentiate between them. It figured that, as one of the most junior Omegas, Steve had probably been assigned to unenviable night shifts, and for matching a few unusual spelling and syntax errors against online writing samples, it had correctly guessed which terminal operator was Steve. To create his simulated wife, Prometheus had created an accurate model of her body, voice, and mannerisms from the many YouTube videos where she appeared, and had drawn many inferences about her life and personality from her online presence. Aside from her Facebook posts, photos she'd been tagged in, articles she'd liked, Prometheus had also learned a great deal about her personality and thinking style from reading her books and short stories. Indeed, the fact that she was a budding author with so much information about her in the database was one of the reasons that Prometheus chose Steve as the first persuasion target. When Prometheus simulated her on the screen using its movie-making technology, it learned from Steve's body language which of her mannerisms he reacted to with familiarity, thus continually refining its model of her. Because of this, her otherness gradually melted away, and the longer they spoke, the stronger Steve's subconscious conviction became that this really was her, resurrected.